Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is June the 26th. We are continuing in Parsha Shmos. And we are on page 310. We're up to Pasuk Chaf Aleph, verse 21. So the last thing we discussed is that Moshe was now going back to Mitzrayim. He had finally agreed to go, and now Hashem has sent him away. He asked permission from his father-in-law Yisro, and now he is headed back. And he took his wife and his children, and he went on the donkey. You remember HaChamor, the donkey? Remember the significance of that special donkey? And now, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, verse 21, Hashem now gives him some more instructions, which he didn't tell him before. Let's read all of the instructions. Vayomer Hashem Moshe. Hashem said to Moshe, "Belech becha lashuv Mitzrayma, when you go back to return to Egypt, re'ei kol hamofsim asher samti v'yadecha, see all of the signs, all the wonders that I've put in your hand. Va'asisam lifnei Pharaoh, you should do them before Paro. Va'ani achazek es libo, I will strengthen his heart. V'lo yeshalach es ha'am, and he will not send out the nation. Va'amarto el Paro, and you shall say to Paro, Shalach, sorry, ko amar Hashem, so says Hashem, b'ni b'chori Yisrael, my son, my b'chor, my firstborn, is Yisrael. Va'omar elecha, and I said to you, Shalach es b'ni v'avdeni, send out my son, and he will serve me. Va'timo'en l'shalacho, and you refuse to send him out, hinei anochi horeg es b'ncha b'chorecha. Behold, I am going to kill your son, your firstborn." That's the end of Hashem's instructions to Moshe. So we have a few things to discuss about these three psukim, these three verses. We have to understand what it is that Hashem is telling Moshe to do. And we also have to understand why Hashem waited until now to say this to Moshe. He already gave him instructions before about what to say to Paro. And here, it seems like this is a separate sivui, a separate command of what to say to Paro. And finally, we have to understand what is this emphasizing of Bechor. This is the first time that the concept of Bechor, of the firstborn, is used in regard to Paro. We know, of course, that eventually the 10th Makkah, the 10th plague, is Makas Bechoros, the death of the firstborn. And we know that's how we leave Mitzrayim, that's how we leave Egypt. So it's going to become very, very significant. But this is the first time it's mentioned, and we have to understand what is this focus on Bechor, on the firstborn. What's so important about it? That Hashem says to Paro, my son, my Bechor is Yisrael. You don't want to let them go. I'm going to kill your son, your Bechor. Mida keneged mida, measure for measure. You're not letting my son, my Bechor, go free to serve me. So I'm going to kill your son, your Bechor. Sounds like there's a direct connection between that.
I'll go with your share that you gave when you first came to visit.
Yes, yes. We're not going to go through that whole thing now. You're right. We had a big share about Bechor and Mitzrayim. That is correct.
Sounds to me like Pharaoh is being put on the level of God. God is talking about his Bechor.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
Pharaoh thinks of himself as a God.
Okay. So you're saying, how can you, even if the comparison, Hashem has a Bechor, Paro has a Bechor. Like, what kind of comparison is that? Okay.
So maybe that's why Paro always denied Moshe, no matter what the plague was, because no firstborn was dying until the very end.
Okay. You mean when all the other plagues were happening, but at least that one wasn't happening. Okay. So why didn't Hashem tell this to Moshe before? It appears, let's look at Chaf Aleph, look at 21 again. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, Belechtecha lashuv Mitzrayma, when you're going to return to Egypt. It seems that these three psukim, these three verses, was something that Hashem wanted Moshe to think about, or to know, or to be focused on, to have a purpose when he's going back to Egypt. See, until now, Hashem only told Moshe, go back to Egypt and take out the Jews. This is a different focus. Until now, it was, you're going to go and take the Jews out of Egypt. This is, you're going to go and you're going to punish Paro and threaten him. So it's not just about taking the Jews out of Egypt. Till now it was, take the Jews out, they're going to serve me, Tavdun Esho Elokim Al Har Hazeh, they're going to serve me on this mountain, and they're going to go to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so the Egyptians are just they're a barrier for the Jews to get out and get the Torah and go to Israel. But the Egyptians are just a sideshow. It's really, now it seems like Hashem is setting up a head-to-head battle with the Egyptians. I'm putting these signs, these wonders in your hands, in your hand. You're going to do them before Paro, and I'm going to strengthen his heart. And he won't send out the nation. And he'll tell Paro, Hashem says, my son, my firstborn is Yisrael. And I told you to let them out to serve me, and you're refusing, so I'm going to kill your son, your firstborn. That's not about the Jews anymore. It's about Hashem against Paro. So it's a different focus over here. And Hashem is telling Moshe, I want you to be thinking about this. I want you to have a purpose as you go back to Egypt. This is the purpose. So it shifts the whole focus of the discussion. Now this is not the first time that Hashem has told Moshe that Paro is not going to let the Jews go because Hashem is going to strengthen his heart. He already told that to Moshe before. He said to Moshe, back on page 306, he said to Moshe to tell Paro that we're going. I want the Jews to go for 3 days to serve Hashem. And if you look at Pasuk Yutes, verse 19, it says, Hashem says to Moshe, Vani adati, I know, ki lo yiten eschem melech Mitzrayim lahaloch, that the king of Egypt won't let you go. V'lo b'yad chazakah. Now, we had two ways of understanding this. Either not because Paro's hand is strong, meaning he's not going to let you go, but not because he's strong. It's going to be because he's going to be stubborn and not let you go. Or the other way to read it is, V'lo b'yad chazakah, he won't let you go unless I hit him with a strong hand. V'shalachties yadiv v'ikesies Mitzrayim, I'm going to send my hand and strike Egypt. V'chol niflo osaya asher eseh v'kirbo, with all of my wonders that it will do in its midst. V'acharechein yishalach eschem. And then they'll send you out. So here Hashem is already telling Moshe that there's going to be plagues. Paro's not going to let them go. And I'm going to hit him again and again and again and again. And finally they'll let him go. So he's already told them there's going to be a series of plagues. But that was just a detail in the larger picture about leaving Egypt. Here, on page 310, this is the focus. There's going to be punishments, plagues, and I'm going to tell Paro that you don't let my firstborn go, I'm going to kill your firstborn. Much more focused on the plagues. Now Rashi tells us that that at the very beginning Moshe was supposed to tell Paro that the final plague is going to be the death of the firstborn. And that unlike a person, unlike flesh and blood, who does not like to play all his cards, Hashem has no problem putting everything on the table. We, when we're bargaining, we're negotiating, so we keep something in our pocket, keep something hidden, because we don't want the other party to know, because we're going to pull it out as a final piece to get what we want. So we're not going to give away everything. We want to keep things close. Hashem isn't afraid. He can tell everything. Because why do we want to hide things and keep them close? Because if I let you know everything, if I'm negotiating with you and I tell you all my secrets, then you're going to figure out a way to get around my threats and my secrets. But Hashem knows you can't get away with it. He can get you no matter what. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't care if Paro knows the last punishment at the beginning, because Paro can't do anything about it. So he says to Moshe, I want you to tell Paro right at the beginning that if you don't let them go, you're going to lose. Hashem's going to kill your firstborn. That's what's going to happen. Let him try to get away from it. It's not going to help. He's going to get beaten anyway. So we're going to see later when we get to Parashas Va'era, which will be, we're going to break for the summer, but it'll be maybe 6 or 7 more shiurim. We'll see that for the first several plagues, Hashem does not have to harden Paro's heart. Paro hardens his own heart. Paro chooses not to let them go. At a certain point, though, he can't take it anymore. And he would have let them go, but Hashem hardens Paro's heart and takes away his ability to choose. Which leaves... What's that? Well, it leads to a philosophical dilemma, which is that how could Hashem take away somebody's free will and then punish them? Mm-hmm. To take away someone's free will, okay, Hashem can take away someone's free will if he wants to. Hashem can choose what to do, and it could be that a certain person, Hashem says, he doesn't have free will anymore. Okay, but then you can't punish him if you take away his ability to choose. A punishment is for choosing to do the wrong thing. So there becomes a dilemma there, which we'll have to tackle when we get to that. And there is a very important Rashi over there. There's a very important Rambam, Maimonides. There's a big discussion which we'll have, and that's not for tonight. But we will, Blinetta, we will tackle that when we get to it in Parshas Va'era.
Isn't the taking away of his free will punishment in itself?
That's one approach. That's one approach. But even that needs to be understood more clearly, because how is that fair to then continue to punish him? To keep on punishing him.
Right?
So we'll have to tackle that. Then there's a lot to talk about there, but that's going to be probably a whole class in and of itself, just that point. From the fact that Hashem emphasizes Bechor, he emphasizes the firstborn, it seems that Paro is going to have or has a disagreement with Hashem or with Moshe about who is the firstborn. What do I mean by that? What is a firstborn? What's the significance of a Bechor, a firstborn? In today's day and age, we don't really think about it so much. Today, you know, we talk about equality and everybody's the same, and we don't think about firstborn in the family, the Bechor. You know, my older brother is a Bechor, right? So in my mind, okay, big deal. I'm not the Bechor, right? But a Bechor is something. We know there's such a thing as a Pinyon HaBen, where we redeem a firstborn. And we know that at least in the laws of inheritance of Yerusha, the Torah does award a double portion for the firstborn. We also know that the Bechoros, the firstborn, were supposed to be the Kohanim. They're supposed to be the ones who serve in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple. They lost that right, but that's what they were supposed to do. But what is this idea of a firstborn? In Europe, and perhaps even in America 100 years ago, it was common practice that the firstborn would follow in the father's vocation. If he had if he was a cobbler, then the firstborn would become a cobbler, a shoemaker. If he was a blacksmith, the firstborn would become a blacksmith. He would take over the father's business. The other children in the family would have to go find their own things. But it would be the firstborn who would take over for the father. That was common. It was commonplace that you had such a thing.
The firstborn was like the future.
Okay. So that's getting more to the point. Children are the continuation of the parents. That's what children are. The firstborn is the one who makes parents into parents. Right? That's the first child. But until the first child is born, they're not parents. The first child, then they become parents. So the firstborn represents, like you said, continuity, right? Carrying on. It's a very interesting. There's a very interesting gematria in numerical value of the letters. I've mentioned this to you before. Bechor is one of the few words that the first letter, Beis, is 2. The second letter, Chaf, is 20. The third letter, Resh, is 200. 2, 20, 200. It's a progression. The opposite of that is Rechev. Rechev means a chariot. 200, 20, 2. It's going down. Bechor is moving up.
Did you say chariot?
Chariot. Chariot. So I once heard from one of my Rebbeim that your chariot is your portable home. It's your home, and you're traveling, you take it with you. But whenever you travel, you can't possibly travel with all of the amenities at home. Even if you have the fanciest RV, it's still not home. It's still going to be your home condensed into something smaller. 222. It gets smaller. Right. You're trying to take as much as you can, right? That's what you're trying, but you can't, right? No matter what, it's not going to be like home. Your a bechor is expansion. 2, 20, 200. It's the expansion into the future. That's bechor. Yeah.
Now, when they say bechor, there, don't they mean the male?
Yes.
Male child.
Yes, they mean the first male child. Correct. That is correct.
That should be mentioned.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah.
Not knowing any Hebrew, I make a funny sort of sound connection between bechor and hira. First will.
Uh huh. Interesting.
Is there any etymological?
The two letters are different. One is a chaf and one is a ches. And in fact,
that makes
yeah. In fact, Sfarim don't even say it the same way. One is a ch sound, bechor, and the other one is more of a he sound, more of a closer to a he. Bechira. It's not exactly.
I
that.
See.
So that's fine. We're talking about human beings, but when you're talking about Hashem, so what does it mean to have my son, my firstborn? Hashem doesn't have children. He's not a human being. He doesn't have a body. He doesn't procreate. You can't. There's no other Hashem. He doesn't have a baby Hashem. There's no adolescent Hashem running around, right? So what does it mean, my son, my firstborn?
Well, there's more when parents have their first child, which I was.
You're a bechor? Okay.
They tend to give more of their time, all, at least in my case, they fought over taking care of me. But it is something a little more significant.
Okay. So are you suggesting that when it says Hashem says the Jews are my son, my firstborn, it means the one that I am more closest to.
Yeah.
I dote on.
Yeah.
I focus on.
But Hashem knows what's going to be, that he's eventually we're the ones that are going to take the lead with through Torah and be the light unto the nations. So that makes you a firstborn.
Okay. So all the things that we've mentioned apply over here conceptually. That we are the ones who Hashem is more focused on, that's true. We are the ones who are supposed to be the ones who are the example for everybody else. Right? That's our responsibility. We're supposed to be the example everybody looks at and says, that's how you're supposed to behave. Right? That's like the firstborn, all the other children are supposed to look at him and say, okay, that's how we're supposed to behave. And also, we are the continuity, not continuity. Hashem lives forever, so you don't have to have continuity if you're living forever, right? So what does it mean, continuity? But we're the expression of Hashem in this world. We're the ones who bring Kavod Shamayim. We bring the honor of heaven into this world. We're the ones who announce to the world that there is a Hashem. As many of the Mefarshim, many of the commentaries say, that the very fact that the Jews still exist is a pronouncement that there is a God. Because if there was no God, we wouldn't be here anymore. It's impossible that we've survived all these years. So we are the ones who bring Hashem into the world. So in that sense, we are His child, but more than His child, we're His Bechor. Now, Paro, as we will see as we move along over here, Paro is going to reject the notion of Hashem. Paro, of course, believed in paganism, in idolatry, but that there is a Hashem, he rejects. Other nations accepted that there was a supreme God, Hashem. It's just that they thought that there were other smaller gods who also had independent power, not as powerful as the supreme God, and those smaller powers were more accessible. For instance, the Plishtim, the Philistines, believed that there was they worshipped an idol called Dagon. Dagon was half fish, half man, because the Plishtim lived on the seashore, where Gaza is today. That was Eretz Plishtim, the land of Plishtim. So they worshipped this half man, half fish. They believed that the sea, the fish, had power. It was a god. It wasn't as powerful as the supreme God, but the supreme God is just much too hard to reach. He's inaccessible. The fish god, he's much more in our realm. We can get to him. The same thing with those who worship the sun, the moon, the rain, the trees, the mountains, whatever it is. They believed that those things have independent power, and as long as I'm nice to the god of rain, the god of rain will be nice to me. The god of rain is not as powerful as the real god, as the supreme god, but there is such a thing as a god of rain who also has power. That was what they believed. And we see this in Nach. When we get to the prophets, we see this because, especially with the Plishtim, they acknowledged that the Jews were worshipping that supreme God. And that if the Jews were getting through to that supreme God, if they were able to break through, which is hard to do, but if they were able to do it, then no one could beat the Jews. They were scared of the Jews if the Jews were in a position where they were actually reaching that supreme God. They knew that their God was no match for the supreme God. It's just that they felt that they couldn't get to the supreme God, so they worshiped these minor gods. That's the way that the most nations of the world dealt with the fact that there is a Hashem. It's not that they rejected that there's Hashem completely, but they believed in these other minor gods. Paro is going to completely reject the notion that there is a Hashem. It's not just that he worshipped minor gods, he rejected the notion that there is a supreme God. And we'll see that. Hashem, as we're going to see later in Parshas Bo, he's going to say it more explicitly, Hashem is going to use Paro to show the world that there is a Hashem. He's not going to use Paro to show the world that all of those minor gods don't exist, which is also true. Of course they don't exist. That's idolatry. You don't believe in idolatry. But that's not the main focus Hashem's going to do over here. He's going to show everybody that there is a supreme God. No one can come along later and say there's no supreme God. Because when you get through all 10 plagues, and especially Kriyas Yamsuf, the splitting of the sea, that is going to show beyond the shadow of a doubt that there is a supreme God in the world. The Hashem here is setting up that struggle, that challenge. I'm telling you, Paro, my firstborn is the Jews. What's my firstborn? The ones that announce my presence in the world are the Jewish people. You don't even think I exist. Not only do I exist, but the Jews are the ones who announce, who proclaim that I exist. It's like they're blowing a trumpet. There is a Hashem. There is a Hashem. That's what the Jews are. You don't believe that? I'm going to kill your firstborn. I'm going to take away your continuity to make the point that I do exist and I have continuity, and that's the Jews. He's setting up that head-to-head battle. Yes?
I hate to... It's a sort of a side question, but what evidence do we have that Plishtim knew that there was a supreme...
It's clear over there in Sefer Shmuel. It's very clear. Because when the Jews do come, the Plishtim get very scared.
Oh, that's right.
They get very scared. They say, oh, the Jews, they're coming with Hashem. They get very, very, they get terrified. Right? Even though they're idolaters. They don't worship Hashem. But they're still scared.
Right? I just want to mention something about the Chor, that the word Bikurim, that connected to the holiday of Shavuot, the first fruits, come from the same Hebrew root, Bet Chafresh. It sounds Bikurim, there's a grammatical reason why, but I like the idea that it's written in the Mishnah, that the person goes down to his orchard and see the first fig or the first pomegranate and mark it, because this is going to be the Bikurim. I'm looking forward for this Bikurim to ripe in order to bring it to the temple. So I think about parents that are looking forward to have the firstborn, and kind of in the same way. And I also have the whole from both sides. Looking for me. And then the second and the third, you have
all this practice. So you spoil it. The second and third is already better. Yeah.
My brother, my older brother, is a Bechor, Ben Bechor.
Oh.
He's a Bechor. His father's a Bechor. My father's a Bechor. And my grandfather, Olam Shalom, was a Bechor. He married a Bechorah, a firstborn girl, who was the daughter of a Bechorah,
Wow.
So the firstborn child of theirs was either going to be a fourth male Bechor in a row, or a fourth female Bechorah in a row.
He had a tough time finding a wife.
Anyway, they had a girl. So his streak was broken, but hers is still going. Pasuk Chaf Dalet, 24. And we have one of the strangest stories in the Chumash. One of the most strange stories in the whole Chumash. So let's just understand this. Hashem has just spent a large amount of time and a lot of ink in the Torah about he's negotiating with Moshe to get him to go down to Egypt. For the burning bush and the whole thing, 7 days, going, I mean, who knows what they were talking to each other about. But for 7 days, and he finally convinces Moshe to go back to Egypt, take the Jews out. Moshe finally agrees, and he gets permission from Yisro, and he's now headed back. So he's going back with his wife, Zipporah, and Vayiva Derech Bamolon, they were on the road in the inn, so they had stopped on the road. Vayifkeshehu Hashem, and Hashem encountered him, they say in the translation. Hashem met Moshe. Vayivakesham Yisro, and he wanted to kill him. That's great. Oh, that's a wonderful plan. We're going to get Moshe. Moshe's all ready to go take the Jews out of Egypt. He's heading down to Egypt. Hashem finds Moshe and wants to kill him. Vatikach Tzipora Tzor. Tzipora, Moshe's wife, took a stone. A tzor is a stone. They say over here, a sharp stone. It had to be sharp. Vatichros es arlas bina. And she cut off the arla of her son. She did a bris milah. She did a circumcision for her new baby. This is Eliezer. His name is not given over here, but later on in the Chumash his name is given. And she performs the circumcision. Vatagal l'raglav. And she threw it down. She threw the stone along with the foreskin that she had cut off. She threw that down at his feet. His feet seems to be the feet of Moshe or the feet of the baby. Vatomer, and she said, Ki chasan domim ata li. You, my baby, are a chasan domim. You're a husband killer for me. You're a husband killer. Chasan, like at a wedding you have a bride and a groom. A bride is a kala, and a groom is a chatan, a chasan. That's what she was saying. You're my husband killer. Vayiref mimenu. He released him. Now, he released him sounds like Hashem released Moshe. Hashem was going to kill Moshe. Now Hashem releases Moshe. Az Amra, then she, meaning Tzipora, said, Chasan Damim Lamulos. The a husband killer for doing mila, doing circumcision. So let me repeat what happened, and then tell you, I can't tell you, there are many ways of explaining these verses. We can't go through every one. I'm going to pick one, and I'm going to go through with you using that approach, but there are other approaches. So let's just repeat the facts that we know. They're headed down to Egypt. They stop at an inn. And Hashem decides to kill Moshe. So somehow, it doesn't say that he grabbed Moshe, but we see from the fact that later it says he released him, that it must be he grabbed Moshe. Somehow, there was some kind of a death grip on Moshe. Somehow. Obviously, Hashem doesn't have a body. So somehow, Hashem caused there to be a death grip, something grabbing Moshe that was going to kill him. When Tzipora saw this, what was her reaction? So she didn't try to get whatever was on Moshe off of Moshe. Instead, she took a sharp stone and circumcised her son, which means that her son had not been circumcised. There was no bris milah on her son, for some reason. So she performs the circumcision. She takes the stone with the foreskin, throws it down to the ground at his feet, and says, "You are my husband killer. You, the baby, you've killed my husband." Then, whatever was gripping Moshe to kill him, let him go. So now Moshe is not going to be killed anymore. He's going to live. So she says, "Husband killer for the circumcision." That's what happened. Clearly, something is going on with this circumcision, with this bris milah, clearly. And somehow that ties in with why Hashem wanted to kill Moshe. And somehow there is, when Tzipora does the bris milah, it stops whatever's going to happen to Moshe.
And how did she know that?
And how did she know? Okay. Now, before we discuss this, I need to tell you a halacha. I need to tell you what it says in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law. Can a woman perform circumcision? Can a woman do bris milah? I think that most males that you know are male. Can a woman perform it? Will it be considered? Is it considered to be a valid circumcision or not? Okay. So this is a debate in the Gemara. The Talmud has a debate about this. One opinion is that a woman can be a moel. I don't know what the feminine of it. Moelet. Okay. That she can do it. The other opinion is, no, she cannot. So the Talmud, the Gemara, asks the obvious question, what do you mean she can't do it? Tzipora did it. So the opinion that says that a woman cannot perform bris milah, meaning that it would be an invalid circumcision if a woman would do it, explains that Tzipora didn't actually do it over here. She took a stone and she had someone else do it. The Torah says she did it, but the intent of the Torah is that she grabbed somebody else and said, "Here, perform the circumcision." That's what it would mean according to that opinion. Of course, that leads to the next question, which is, well, then can a non-Jew do it? But that wouldn't really play in over here, because remember, there were no Jews or non-Jews, because we didn't have the Torah yet. So this is pre-Torah, so we don't have a nation of Jews and those who are Gentiles who are not Jews. We don't have that clear separation yet. So,
is that the reason a woman can't do it?
According to the opinion that says a woman can't do it, it would simply be because the Torah says no. It wouldn't be because of any...
And nobody knows why?
Well, maybe there's some explanation, but that wouldn't be just like every other mitzvah in the Torah. There are things that can be done by some people, not by other people, and that's the way it is. Now, so what is the conclusion in the Shulchan Aruch? The conclusion is that because it is a debate, it is best if a male does the circumcision. In a case where there is no man available, then a woman can do the circumcision. That's the conclusion of the discussion in the Shulchan Aruch. Yes?
If a woman does it and it's
and it would be considered invalid, what would be the baby situation?
Right.
You can't be circumcised.
Okay, so that's a good question. That's true any time a circumcision is performed in a way that is invalid. What happens if it's done before the eighth day in the hospital? That's an invalid circumcision. So now what? You can't cut off the foreskin if it's not there anymore, right? So what do you do about that?
Mm-hmm.
Or what happens if a non-Jew performs the circumcision, even on the eighth day? So now what? So there is a debate about this, whether there is a way of salvaging the situation. And the way that we rule is that a little bit of blood needs to be drawn, and that would count as the circumcision. It's called hatafas dam bris, taking out a little drop of blood. This happens more frequently than happens very frequently. It happens with converts, because since in the United States circumcision is common amongst non-Jews, very often when a male non-Jew wants to convert, so we know that conversion for a male requires going to the mikvah just like a woman, accepting the mitzvahs, accepting the commandments just like a woman, but also circumcision. But he can't do circumcision because it was done already. So now what? So what we do is this process of drawing a little bit of blood. It is a very, very, very minor cut. It's really not a big deal at all. It's embarrassing, of course, but it is not in any way a traumatic experience. An actual circumcision on an adult, someone who hasn't been circumcised at all, is very traumatic. But that little, taking out a little bit of blood is really nothing. It's just
effort now is non-Jews. They're getting away from circumcision.
Yeah. Now this pendulum is swinging. Right, the pendulum is swinging, but it's still very commonly done. It's still very commonly done.
Well, not as much as
it used to be. Not as much as it used to be, yeah.
Yeah, well, in San Francisco, that's an add-on.
Well, the baby that Moshe and Zipporah had, is he past the age of circumcision?
Okay, so clearly if she's doing the circumcision, he must be at least 8 days old.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is how Rashi understands what happened over here. Remember that that we already learned before, it was already explicit in Parsha Shmos, that Moshe and Zipporah had a firstborn baby. That was Gershom. And he was already born before. This is a second baby. This is Eliezer, as we find out later in Parsha Sisra, we find out what his name is. But right now, we just know that there's a baby. Rashi explains that with all this that was going on, with the burning bush, and with going back to Yisro and getting permission to leave and all that, Zipporah was in her 9th month. And Hashem is telling Moshe, go back to Egypt.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Delta wouldn't let her on the plane at this point. Right? And they're traveling back to Egypt. And so that's hard to do. I mean, in their day especially, traveling, you know. So Moshe reasoned, I got to go because Hashem said to go. I have to leave. Zipporah had her baby right before they left. A few days before they left. So Moshe says, what am I supposed to do now? But Hashem said to go. So he says, okay, if Hashem says jump off the Empire State Building, I got to jump off the Empire State Building. So Hashem said to go, I got to go. So even though they had a newborn infant, they traveled. And they did. But in so doing, they did not perform the circumcision because Moshe said, I can't perform the circumcision and then travel. So they traveled. They get to the inn, and at that point, they could perform the circumcision. And this is the way Rashi understands it, that Moshe then should have immediately performed the circumcision because it's already late. So it's the first chance you get, you do it. And instead, Moshe first made sure that their accommodations were set, took care of the inn first. So because he delayed in taking care of the circumcision, was what he should have done, this is the way Rashi understands it. Therefore Hashem punished him, and punished him harshly. Hashem was going to kill him for that, which is very harsh. Just because he delayed the circumcision. Right. Okay. So now the fact that it's a harsh punishment that already we find frequently that the great ones get harsh punishments because they're on such a high level that even the tiniest thing that they do wrong, Hashem punishes very harshly. Okay, that's difficult for us to accept. We're not on that level, but that's we find all the time in the Chumash. Fine. But how did Tzipora know? So Rashi says, how did Hashem want to kill him anyway? Rashi says, Hashem sent a snake to swallow Moshe. Now right now, alarm bells should be ringing in your head. Is this the first encounter Moshe has with a snake?
No.
And he ran away from it, right? That was already before. Moshe and snakes is a recurring theme. Keep that in mind as we go through the Chumash. Moshe and snakes. It's constant. So Moshe, a snake comes, according to the way the Medrash, the Rashi says, and swallows Moshe. I guess it's one of these, what do you call those snakes that can...
Like a whale.
No, what do you call this?
Pythons.
Pythons, or one of those things. So it swallows Moshe. First swallowing him, I forget which way it was first, either from head or from feet, but swallowing him from one, head first, to the waist, then letting him go, and swallowing him from his feet to the waist. So from the fact that it swallowed him in those two directions, to the waist, Tzipora understood that that's where the problem was. And so she was a smart woman. So then she, not just smart, but resourceful, especially if you say that she performed the circumcision. I mean, she was not a trained male, right? So that it's pretty unbelievable. So she grabbed a stone, either she grabbed it or she had someone else do it, and she performed the circumcision. Now she thought that her husband was as good as dead. He was going to be punished because he didn't perform the circumcision. And so she was now being mechaper, she was atoning for his sin by doing the circumcision, but she figured it's all over. And that's why she said, you, my son, are my husband killer. But then, the snake let him go. It didn't kill him. It was going to kill him, but now it didn't. So then she retracted, and she said, it is the lack of circumcision that was going to kill my husband. That's what was going to kill my husband. But now that the circumcision was done, I see my husband is not going to get killed. That's the way Rashi understands the sequence of events. Now this does not explain everything, and we have to hit on two very important points. Yeah. Okay. Okay, maybe there'll be a resurrection of some sort.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Is this the wife being connected?
You mean because she's doing, yeah. You're saying Ezer Kenego, a helpmate that corresponding to him. So she is making up for his lack. He didn't do it, so she does it. It could very well be. It could very well be. It seems to me that when she says, you are a husband killer to me, it seems to me that the very fact that his name is not mentioned over here, Eliezer, it seems to me that she's naming the baby. When do you name a baby? Boy.
At the bris.
And in their day, they would always name for events. We find that when the Shvatim, when the tribes were born, that they were named for the whatever was going on at the time. We find when Yaakov was born, he's called heel because he was holding on to the heel of Esav. And we have Yitzchak was called Yitzchak because of the laughing, because of the joy in his birth. We find that all the time. It seems to me she was actually naming him. She was saying to him, you are a husband killer. Because that's his birth. Killed her husband. But then,
what is the word she uses?
Chasan damim. It's the blood of my husband. Then when it lets him go, when the snake lets him go, she says, no. It's not the baby who's the husband killer. It was just the circumcision. And now that the circumcision is done, I see he's going to live. Then they renamed him, and they named him Eliezer, which means God is my help. That helps me. Many of the commentaries like to point out over here, Tzipora and Moshe are married certainly for several years. This is their second child, so this is not newlyweds. Yet she refers to her husband as Chatan, which means a groom. That there seems to have been this sense of closeness between Tzipora and Moshe that she calls them Chasan, even though evidently they're not newlyweds. Okay, it's an interesting observation. Fine. So, good, this episode is interesting to me. Obviously, it's strange, like, you know, he's going to take the Jews out of Egypt, and then he has this minor thing that he does wrong with the circumcision. Okay, so Hashem's going to kill him. Zipporah figures it out and say, it all happens, fine, but it's just, and what would have been plan B? If Moshe would have been killed, now what?
Wouldn't be in a Jewish community.
He was bringing Aaron with him.
Zipporah. What's that?
He was bringing Aaron with him.
Aaron was in Egypt. He's going to meet Moshe soon. That's the next thing.
Well, it couldn't have happened that he was really going to die. There's big lessons in here for us.
How do you know? Maybe would have.
God wouldn't have gone through this whole thing of getting him ready.
Maybe there would have been another burning bush, from somebody else. I don't know. Okay, but you're saying it would have been unbelievable for Moshe to die. I mean, we know what the future is.
The goal has purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
And that it's put in this bizarre place has purpose.
Okay. So I think that the reason why the story is here, and perhaps even the reason why Hashem dealt so harshly with Moshe, actually threatening to kill him, and maybe he wasn't going to do it. I don't know. There's no way for us to know because he didn't get to do it, right? But I think that the reason why this is here is because when Moshe is going back to Egypt, as soon as Moshe walks in, as we mentioned before, this is really a struggle between Hashem and Paro. Paro says, there is no Hashem. Hashem says to Paro, I'm here, and you're going to know it. By the time we're done, you're going to be yelling it that I'm here. You're going to be screaming that I'm here. If this is a Hashem versus Paro thing, it's very easy to start to think as you move along that this is a Moshe versus Paro thing. Because Moshe comes into Paro, and Paro says to Moshe, I don't want to see your face. Moshe says, fine, you won't see my face. Like, there's going to be a struggle, a battle between Moshe and Paro. And one could become sidetracked and believe that this is about Moshe versus Paro. And that's not what it's about. Hashem versus Paro. As many of us know, the Haggadah on Pesach doesn't mention Moshe, except for one time Moshe is mentioned only because they were quoting that particular verse. But Moshe is not the focus on the night of Pesach. The focus is Hashem taking us out, not Moshe. It seems to me the story is here to show us Moshe was the agent of Hashem, the shliach.
Expendable.
But he's expendable. We don't need him. Moshe can be killed, we'll still get out of Egypt. Hashem doesn't need Moshe. He doesn't need Moshe. He chooses to do it through Moshe. But Hashem can do it also without Moshe. Moshe is not necessary for Yetzias Mitzrayim, for the Exodus. Don't start to think that, if it wasn't for Moshe, what would have happened? Well, it would have been some other way.
I was just remembering, if I'm correct, that when the Jews were in the desert for the 40 years, they did not circumcise, which is why they had to do circumcision
in the time of Yahushua.
They went into Israel.
Correct.
So how could they choose not to?
Well, they did circumcise when they left Egypt.
Yeah, but
right. Then in the desert they weren't able to because it would have been dangerous. The Gemara says that the climate was such that it would have been dangerous for them to circumcise the children. The question is, why did Hashem set it up that way that they would be in a position where they couldn't circumcise their children? Which is a very good question. That is a good question. And I hope we will deal with that when we get to Yehoshua. I hope we will deal with that. Yeah. Okay, we have one more class before we break for the summer. Next week, Mitzvah Hashem, that's July 3rd, regular time. We have one more class, and then we will break all the way till the end of August.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the Donate link. Thank you very much.